This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Adults have always worried about their sick and aging parents, but there are many ways in which our current situation is unique. Psychologist Mary Pfeiffer writes about that territory in her new book, Another Country. Pfeiffer, who is now in her early 50s, spent a lot of time caring for her mother during her mother's last year of life. Pfeiffer says many of her friends and clients worry about their parents' doctors, their parents' driving, their finances, and their living arrangements. As part of the research for her new book, Pfeiffer interviewed and saw in therapy many people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. One of her goals is to help the generations understand each other. Pfeiffer is also the author of Reviving Ophelia, the bestseller about adolescent girls and the problems they face. I asked her what she thinks is unique about the situation faced by adult children and their aging, sick parents today.
Well, up until very recently, one of the major differences, of course, is there weren't nearly as many old people because people just died earlier. And it was very uncommon for someone 50 years old to have two living parents as well as two living in-law parents. So there's more older people to take care of. Another difference is we're geographically dispersed. So that it used to be, for example, very common for aging parents to move in with their children. Now, oftentimes, aging parents are 1,000 miles away. The children live in condos. The wives are working as opposed to at home and available to be useful. So one way to think about the baby boomer generation is we may be the first generation that does not automatically assume that our aging parents will live with us.
As you point out, we just don't seem to have many systems in place to deal with the new dilemmas that are being posed to us. What kind of structures do you think we lack that we need?
Well, I do think that there's nothing in our culture that makes aging easy. And I'm not an expert on things like the housing situation or the medical situation, but what I end up talking about mostly is the difficulties in just staying connected to older people. I tell a story in the book about calling one of my aunts, and this aunt is a lovable person. She has so many family members and friends. She was getting ready to face a surgery, and I actually had trouble getting into her because so many other people were calling her to say they loved her and wished her well and so on. Finally, I got her, and she was very upset because she'd been given an enema and was worried she couldn't get to a bathroom by herself. The nurse wasn't answering her buzzer. And she tried to be polite to me as I told her I loved her and wished her luck. But I could tell that her mind was really very preoccupied with worries about getting to the bathroom. And after I hung up from my conversation with my aunt, I thought to myself, you know, she has a whole lot of people that love her and care for her, but she has nobody right beside her to get her to the bathroom at this moment. And it really got me thinking about the importance of just physically being with old people. There's so many things that really old people need that can't be hired.
Now, you had a mother who was very sick. Your mother has since passed. And when your mother was sick, you lived about 3 hours away, and you also had two teenage children at the time. And you write a little bit about some of the problems you faced. You say that you alternated between feeling very guilty and very angry. What did you feel guilty and angry about?
Well, first of all, one experience I had, my mother was unique in that she was in the hospital almost an entire year, which most people aren't able to talk hospitals into keeping them that long in the 90s. But because she'd been a physician, I think she had a little extra pull and was able to be hospitalized. But at any rate, one of the problems I had that last year of her life was no matter where I was, I felt guilty. If I was with my mother, I was aware that I wasn't seeing my psychotherapy patients, that I wasn't dealing with teenage children that needed supervision and a parent. If I was with my kids, I was aware that for the most part, my mother was alone in a hospital, not very able to take care of herself. If I was with my therapy clients, I was aware that both my mother and my children weren't getting the attention they needed. So I did. I really felt like no matter how hard I worked and how fast I ran, I could not be the places I needed to be every day. And I always kind of went to sleep feeling I should have done this, I should have done that. The rage really had to do with the fact that My own mother was not a terribly practical person, particularly as she got older and was oxygen deprived and ill. Some of her decisions were pretty irrational. She hadn't done particularly good planning, so that sometimes I would be so upset with her for not making my life easier, in a sense, for coming up with ways to handle things that were very complicated for me. I felt a lot of anger at just the systems that I had to work with, the insurance system and the banking system. There were so many very complicated institutional problems that I had to deal with at the same time I was dealing with a very sick and ill mother. So it's a very frustrating experience. And I think the way I put it in the book, the only worse thing than having an aging parent is not having an aging parent, because I felt very sorry for myself and very stressed that entire year that my mother was dying. And then she died, and I had the grief of losing a mother.
What were your mother's expectations of you, and did you think that those expectations were fair and reasonable?
Well, my mother was like many Plains women that came of age during the years she came of age in the 20s and 30s. In other words, she was a tough cookie. She was not a complainer. I had tremendous respect for the way she handled her death. In that entire year when she went without, you know, fresh air on her face or a good meal or an opportunity to see a sunset or anything like that. But the thing I learned from my mother's death, and that I try to, one of the reasons I wrote this book is to help readers who are facing or will be facing the illness and death of a parent have some ideas for how to make it as positive experience, as painless experience as possible. I mean, of course, it won't be painless, but some of the complications can be avoided if there's good planning and if there's conversation in advance. For example, in retrospect, I really wish before my mother had gotten so ill, we'd sat down, we'd gone over her finances, we'd gone over things like living wills, her ideas about rest homes, and so on and so on. None of that had really been worked out. I also wish I'd known the names of all the people she considered close friends so that I could have hooked more people in to helping me. I wish my siblings and I had really gotten organized and said, okay, let's each of us take one or two major tasks for dealing with our mother. And if we'd gone into it with more planning and more conversation, it would have been a better process. It would have gone better for me and for my mother.
Now, you talked a little bit about feeling guilt and anger when you were taking care of your mother. What advice do you give people about dealing with their guilt and anger?
Well, one of the things I think is really important is to say that the process of helping a beloved parent die is an intrinsically painful, frustrating, upsetting process. And it's better to have that expectation going into it. It's better to admit that everybody involved in the process is human, that people can't be heroic all the time. It's important, for example, to pace oneself because it's not a sprint. It's a marathon in many cases. And it really is a big mistake to pull out all the stops and be heroic for the first 2 weeks of what's going to end up being a 7 months long process. The main thing I want to tell people my age who are moving into this time in their lives is there's very important reasons to hang in there and help your parents. First of all, it's your last chance to grow up. It's a real opportunity to be a true adult. And if you say no, I think there's a part of you that stays forever an adolescent. Another thing is it offers you an opportunity to do some healing in the parent-child relationship, because your parent, as they age, is not a harsh authoritarian figure in most cases, but rather a kind of a sad older person that needs help. And it's a good time to work through a lot of the stuff that's piled up over the course of a lifetime. It's a good time to hear family stories. Who else but parents are going to talk to you about what you were like in second grade? It's also a good time to teach your children this is the way we treat older relatives, because they will learn from you how to treat you when you are old. So it makes a lot of sense to show them a kind example.
My guest is psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, author of the new book, Another Country, Navigating the Emotional Terrain of Our Elders. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Pfeiffer. She's a psychologist who's the author of the best-selling book, Reviving Ophelia, and a new book called Another Country, Navigating the Emotional Terrain of Our Elders. Now, you point out that a lot of adult children who are taking care of their older adult parents still have a lot of unresolved conflicts between them. You know, things that were unsettled from 30 years ago or 40 years ago when the adult children were child children. What are some of the typical conflicts that you think are still unresolved and flare up as the adult children take care of their older parents?
Well, the things I tend to write about in this book are things like role reversal, you know, and the fact that all of a sudden the son is taking the car keys from the father. Those are very difficult situations. I also talk about what I call updating old pictures, which is for perhaps, for example, as a teenager, the baby boomer was kind of irresponsible. Now they're 50. They're an investment banker. They're not the slightest bit irresponsible. But say the father who's ill and dying still has a lot of doubts because he's looking at pictures he has in his mind of his son as a 14-year-old. So one of the things that's very important to do is encourage both the aging parents and the baby boomers to update their pictures of the people they're dealing with and not be looking at 30, 40-year-old pictures. That's very important. Another thing that may be a problem is something as simple as sibling rivalry. You know, most families have a pretty good healthy dose of that. And all of a sudden, when a parent is aging, sibling rivalry can rear its ugly head again. And there can be, for example, one place you see this, Terry, is with wills. There can be a lot of disputes about something like who gets mom's feather pillow. Well, it's obviously probably not really about this incredibly valueless feather pillow. It's about something else. It's about love or nurturance or who did mom love the most and so on.
I think there's sometimes misunderstandings in communications between older parents and adult children. For example, you give a good one in your book that sometimes parents really want to protect their kids from worrying about them. So a parent might be very sick and not really communicate the full pain that they're feeling or the real prognosis that the doctor's given them. And yet the kid feels that their biggest worry is that they're not finding out the real truth. They don't have the real picture. And that worries them a lot more than the truth ever could.
That's a very good example from the book. And it sort of goes back to the two major differences I see between us and our parents' generation. And one is this business of they grew up in a communal culture where behavior matters a great deal, and where it's very important to be cooperative and a team player and well-mannered. It's very important to be well-mannered. And also, they grew up pre-psychology, so that the two generations have very different ideas about how to process pain, how to handle adversity. And a lot of times, there's cultural collisions between baby boomers and their parents as they have to deal with things like, for example, a diagnosis of cancer.
Yeah, you know, speaking of psychology, you say that you expected when you started this book that the biggest divide between elderly people and their adult children would be technology. But you found the real divide was psychology, that, say, the baby boom generation grew up with an understanding of psychology and their parents didn't grow up in that psychoanalysis era, and that they just have different ideas about expressing emotions and dealing with emotions and communicating.
You know, there are so many ways that psychology has entered the culture and changed the way people view good mental health. Just for example, our parents' generation, for the most part, really believed in letting sleeping dogs lie, that if there was bad news in the family, bad news in the community, the politest thing to do was not talk about it. And on the other hand, our generation has been taught process, 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 share your feelings, emote. And so when we deal with things with our parents, we sometimes see them as in denial, as secretive. And they, on the other hand, see us as sometimes as whiners, as complainers, as spilling out family secrets. Sometimes it's a very comical situation. Sometimes it's very sad.
Did you start seeing more clients as a psychotherapist who were dealing with ailing older adult parents when you were writing this book?
Over the years, I've seen a lot of clients who dealt with older parents, and I've seen a lot recently because therapists tend to see people their own age. And, of course, people my age are the people who are dealing with aging parents. The other – I tried to lure as many old people into therapy as I could, and it was a tough go. I mean, I offered to see people free. I cut my rates way down. But one of the things that really got me thinking about this psychology business was how hard it was to get older people into therapy, and how when they came into therapy, their reactions to therapy were very different than the reactions of our therapized generation.
How so?
Funny things would happen. Like, for example, I had one client in therapy who spent almost an entire session explaining to me how to cook a Thanksgiving turkey. And I told my husband later, I don't want that to ever be played as great moments of psychotherapy with Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. But the fact of the matter is, she came in before Thanksgiving. She was kind of a lonely woman. She'd always taken great pride in her cooking. She wouldn't be cooking a turkey. She asked me if I would be, and when I said sure, she asked if I knew how. And then when she ascertained that I really didn't know how from her point of view, to her that was the most important thing to talk about. And I would gently try to steer the conversation back to her feelings. She thought, why waste time talking about my feelings when we have this important discussion of a Thanksgiving turkey? One of the things I learned seeing older people in therapy was that what I considered a therapeutic discussion might be very different from what they wanted to talk about. And I ended up allowing them to set the agenda and sometimes being a little embarrassed about what the agenda was, and yet realizing in the end that they knew what they needed to do. They knew, just like younger people do, what made sense for them, and that it was wise to respect that.
My guest is psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, author of the new book, Another Country, Navigating the Emotional Terrain of Our Elders. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mary Pfeiffer is my guest. She's the author of the bestseller, Reviving Ophelia. Her new book is called Another Country, Navigating the Emotional Terrain of Our Elders. I think one of the incredibly difficult decisions that a lot of adult children have to make about their parents, if their parent is sick, is will they invite their parent to live with them? Mm-hmm. Or will, if the parent lives far away, will the adult child move to be closer to the parent?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
will they try to put the parent in a home or an assisted living situation? And I'm wondering if you have come up with any advice for the people who you've worked with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're absolutely right that this decision of where people live is incredibly important, is critically important. And it's about housing, but it's about a lot of other things, too. One thought I have about it is it's primarily a values decision, because as you age and as you're thinking, where do I want to be in my last years, the main thing to think about is what's most important to me. Is it relationships? Is it beautiful places? Is it good health care? Different people come up with different answers, although I think in the end, most people decide relationships are the most important. I like Greg Brown, the songwriter's line, you can't have a cup of coffee with the landscape. And I think many people decide to be near their parents. I don't make recommendations to people of take your parent into your home or anything like that, because what I try to do is encourage people to think about the issues but make very particular decisions based on the quality of their relationship with their parents, their living situation, the different options they have available. I do know that were I selecting an assisted living facility, I would not pay as much attention as most people do to the architecture and the furniture. What I would be paying attention to is, how are the old people enjoying themselves at meals? Is there, I'd go sit in on a dinner or two. Is there a lot of laughter and conversation? Is the food good? I'd go to the activities that are listed on the bulletin board and see, are a lot of people showing up and are they really having fun? I'd ask the staff, how many of the people in this institution are on medications like sleeping pills and tranquilizers and sedatives? And depending on the percentage, I would stay away from places where people are heavily medicated. I think it's really important in evaluating a placement for an older person to be thinking about, can the older person find friends? Will they be useful? Will they have a sense of purpose at this place? And how easy is it going to be for me to stay connected to them, to enjoy visiting them at this place, and so on?
I think a real issue for adult children taking care of their older parents is how much of the adult's child's life should they devote to taking care of the parent when the parent is ill enough that it could be a full-time job taking care of them.
Mm-hmm.
How much of your personal life do you give up? How much of your working life do you give up? How much do you cheat on the job so that you can do better by your parent? How much do you cheat the time that you're giving your children, if you have children of your own, or your spouse, yeah, if you're married?
You know, I look back on that year that my mother was dying and I had teenagers. And I realize now, I wish I'd done more thinking about it in the context of my whole life, because I tried to do three things very well. I tried to work, I tried to be a good mother, and I tried to be a good daughter. In retrospect, I wish I'd put my work on hold. I wish I'd just stopped taking clients, decided to cut back my therapy to a couple days a week, which I know is not an option everyone has. But in retrospect, I wish I had just said, this year is going to be about caring for an aged parent and getting my teenagers through the year, and other stuff will have to wait. I think if I'd done that, I would have been less crazy. Now, I'm not saying that's the decision other people would make, but I'm saying that's a good process to think over the scope of my lifetime, given this is a unique moment in time for me, and given I'm going to have a whole lifetime to reflect on the decisions I make about how I spend time this year. What is it I'm going to want to tell myself 20 years from now about what I did well in 1999? And so I think that kind of sorting may be really good. You know, the other thing is, we baby boomers have really been socialized to believe that the great joys in life have to do with treating ourselves, taking care of ourselves, having adventures, having time to ourselves, and so on and so on. And I certainly am a believer in time to oneself and great moments and being good to oneself, etc. However, one of the things we have not been socialized as much to believe is the great joy in being useful. And there is, in fact, a tremendous sense of satisfaction that comes from feeling needed, feeling that you've taken a very bad day and turned it into a good day for somebody who's in pain and ill. And one of the things I did not anticipate in that last year of seeing my mother through her illness was the real satisfaction I started to have when I would show up in her hospital room and see her face light up and realize how important my visits were to her. And that felt very good to me.
For some people, you know, they have to make the choice about whether to move into or move a parent into an assisted living situation or a nursing home. And mm-hmm. I think the assumption is that people are dragged away to those places kicking and screaming, nobody wants to go. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you find that to be true, or if there are times when people actually appreciate the assistance in assisted living situations.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, most people do not want to go into a nursing home. And many people, once they're in nursing homes, hate them. That's one. I mean, I've had people just look me in the eye and say, I would rather die than be in this place any longer. I mean, there's a real sadness in many people that they're in a nursing home. On the other hand, people sometimes love nursing homes. I tell a story in the book of an older woman who was very isolated, who moved into a nursing home and for the first time in her adult life was going to card parties, was enjoying meals with her peers. She was having a wonderful time. Somebody was taking the trouble to bring her large print books so that she was reading again for the first time in years. So they aren't always bad. Furthermore, there's things that children can do. Like one thing I write about is some of the baby boomers write letters of introduction to the staff and tell the staff a lot about their father or mother. And that helps make the father or mother a person to the people. Also, it's great if, for example, your parent loves music, if you can go to the trouble to get a piano or a stereo system or whatever it is in the bedroom. There's starting to be a real feeling of change in assisted living and rest home facilities. For example, here in Lincoln, more and more are allowing people to have pets. Children are coming in and working. So I think they're going to improve. For one thing, I think us baby boomers are going to demand better facilities for ourselves. We're pretty good at getting what we want, too.
Well, Mary Pfeiffer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Mary Pfeiffer's new book is called Another Country, Navigating the Emotional Terrain of Our Elders. She's also the author of the bestseller Reviving Ophelia about adolescent girls.